you want a vision of the future, Winston, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Someone is trying to teach me a lesson in futility. Why am I the only one who isn't killed?
They will run you dizzy. They will pile falsehood on top of falsehood until you can't tell a lie from the truth and you won't even want to. That's how the powerful keep their power. Don't you read the papers?
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, sir, you.
Plastics.
I'm going to get your money for you. But if you don't get the President of the United States on that phone, you know what's going to happen to you?
What?
You're going to have to answer to the Coca-Cola company.
The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale. It has been since man crawled out of the slime.
Welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It is my pleasure to have Jeremy Rothkeschel and Greg McCarron back on the show. They are, of course, the co-host of the Antidote podcast. Jeremy, Greg, how you doing?
Doing well. Thank you very much for having us back on, Tim.
Oh, you're
doing
welcome.
Great. Thanks.
Okay, well, you had a podcast covering the legacy of Martin Luther King, and I thought it warranted a longer discussion, so thanks for coming back on. So, Martin Luther King, the Civil Rights Movement, dialectics. it's kind of it wasn't just a simple matter of the United States extending the Bill of Rights and all the rights and privileges of the wider white population to the black population. There's a lot more going on at the time. This was the 1960s, the tumult of the 1960s, the Vietnam War. The activism, the in-the-streets protests, these things weren't just spontaneous. They were being manipulated by other forces. So, it's a lot more interesting than, like anything in history, it's a lot more interesting than what the textbooks tell us. So, what was going on in the 1960s with Martin Luther King, the Civil Rights Movement, and everything else? So, who wants to take it? Who wants to lead off?
I'd like to lead off real quick because I think with our program, with our program that we did, I think we had a couple of different goals. And I think the primary goal of this program was to show that, you know, this man, Martin Luther King, is much more complicated than any type of legacy that he has given either within the mainstream media or the so-called alternative media. Because much like John F. Kennedy and the Kennedy family, people have their boxes, particularly within the establishment, that they want to fit Martin Luther King into. For example, the establishment narrative of history has MLK as just the smiling civil rights activist who's the epitome of the very strong talking, very powerful speaker, the eloquent civil rights activist that the mainstream narrative has created for us, that he was simply that, and that he would be very proud of where this country is and everything that's happened, because the narrative of King is that his vision for civil rights is exactly what has happened over the past 5 or 6 decades. And of course, when you take into consideration a lot of the very controversial factors regarding his assassination, as well as a lot of the activism that he did, particularly in the last years of his life when he shifted his activism from just domestic and started focusing on a more global vision. You can see that his legacy very much does not add up to what the mainstream establishment narrative would like people to believe. But also, even within the alternative media, there's a, I think, particularly within a lot of right-wing circles, this might be the prevalent narrative within, say, for example, the alternative right, is that, well, we don't have to worry about Martin Luther King because he was nothing more than a plagiarist and a womanizer and a communist who was trained in a communist training school, which is how their narrative goes. Therefore, nothing he ever said or did actually matters. We shouldn't look at him any further than being just another degenerate and another pawn of communism efforts to destroy America, to make America weak and to create a perpetual. And so these narratives, you get tied into these boxes, and this is a much more complicated man with a much more complicated legacy than most anybody, I think, really has a realization of. So I think his legacy is twofold. First of all, I think here's a man who, in portions of his life, through much of his activism, I think people like E. Michael Jones have done a great job of breaking this down, that King, in a lot of ways, was a pawn of people who most likely were not actual representatives of actual civil rights, of actual justice, of actual equality, of achieving actual equality, but rather come out of this matrix that I think of this, maybe you could call it Judeo-British Masonic background, which is exemplified in organizations such as the Anti-Defamation League, which is directly results from the Masonic B'nai B'rith organization, as well as the NAACP, which in many ways I think is very much an offshoot, very much just like the Anti-Defamation League, founded by many of the same people with many of the same interests. And when you really look at these organizations and what they represent, you really see that they're not really about achieving equality and achieving justice, but these are the people who were behind Martin Luther King, come from these organizations, and in many ways I think his activism was very much manipulated and twisted. For example, sent into Chicago with no idea of how the ethnic politics in Chicago worked, and that was a disaster, and he was doomed to fail with that. But I think that towards the end, I think Martin Luther King even made a lot of his would-be handlers very angry when he started speaking out against the Vietnam War and started making strides toward actually making more of a global effort with his activism, starting to tie the struggles of the poor here in America with those overseas who suffered as a result of the U.S. foreign policy at the time, particularly in Southeast Asia, where the Vietnam War was raging and King had started to educate himself on some of the criminality taking place. And the author William Pepper played a crucial role in his shaping the narrative that he took in the last years of his life. And I would highly recommend William Pepper's work to anybody who's interested in getting a much deeper perspective on the King assassination that is not out there and that is kept from us by so many who would rather not speak the full truth about what happened in 1968. So that, in a nutshell, I think is kind of what we strive to achieve with this program and where we're trying to go with our work as related to Dr. King.
Yes, and in certain ways, I think last time we spoke, Tim, we talked a little bit about the complex history of what's been called the Civil War. And similarly to the emancipation of black slaves in the United States of America and the Reconstruction period post-Civil War, the mainstream narrative is not as complex as reality, and it's not as dark as the reality of the situation. And we talked a little bit about the roots of the B'nai B'rith, the Judeo-Masonic secret society that is still around to this day, and the role that certain key elements of it played in the Confederacy and in intelligence networks surrounding the Civil War. And then, of course, in the wake of that, we can see right in between, in certain ways, the Civil War and the civil rights movement. Civil, there's a commonality there. That 100-year span, in some way, I believe we also talked about this very intense moment of the 19s, specifically around the rise of the so-called Anti-Defamation League, which was already deeply involved. The birth of it was deeply involved in the complex racial dynamics and politics post-Reconstruction South, let's say, in terms of a local B'nai B'rith leader down in Georgia, I believe, Leo Frank, being accused and convicted of raping and killing a teenage girl. And then elements, apparently, of the B'nai B'rith community, very likely, of the brotherhood, the Judeo-Masonic brotherhood of some sort, forming a phalanx around Frank and beginning to try to blame the murder and the rape on a series of black men in many ways. And then it ultimately ended up in the lynching of Leo Frank by people in the community who felt like he was going to be getting off because of politics. So that's a very rough beginning of an organization such as the Anti-Defamation League. But I believe bringing that up is crucial because of the intimacy of the politics, especially of the South in relationship to blacks and Jews and Gentiles, that begin to also play itself out more in the mid 20th century surrounding the civil rights movement. And I called it the so-called Anti-Defamation League because, as we've seen through the years, we probably should remove the word anti from its name and just call it the DL, the Defamation League. And there's actually a very interesting documentary by an Israeli documentarian called Defamation that goes to toward some of the questions surrounding what the Anti-Defamation League is actually doing. And more we've seen that the Anti-Defamation League over the years played a key role in being basically an intelligence arm that straddles both the U.S. security complex, intimately tied to the FBI. Actually, the FBI came into being in a very similar time scheme, but also straddling after the founding of the Jewish state in 48, then you begin to see that the Anti-Defamation League more and more plays the role of an informant and an intelligence network, predominantly in the United States, but actually more and more globally around the world. And it is a key piece, I believe, to this story of the relationship of the civil rights movement to not only the so-called American national security state and the key role that Dr. William Pepper has exposed in court and in writing of the head of the FBI in the murder of King, but then also through the years and the decades after the civil rights movement's heydays of the 50s and 60s and the assassination of King in 68, we also then see the continuing agenda of managing what I've called the black logos in terms of the public words and political logic of the black community being very much managed in many ways by aspects of Jewish power networks and the U.S. deep security state, including this episode in the 80s where the Anti-Defamation League was caught spying on activists by using a police informant that had intelligence connections to the CIA up in the Bay Area and using a contractor to interface with that police agent to get access records of tens of thousands of activists. And what it exposed and what I believe the ADL was very uncomfortable about was not only that they were working on behalf of a foreign government in terms of Israel, but there was a conjunction with the South African intelligence, where there was similarly in the way that the NSA raw data is passed on not only to the Five Eyes of the British Commonwealth, but also very directly to the Israeli NSA Unit 8200, the ADL was passing on this intelligence about not only anti-apartheid activists, but also Palestinian activists, and actually activists of a lot of different sorts that didn't seem to be up the alley of the interest of the Israeli security state. And so there was a sort of throughput and a conjunction of the Israeli intelligence services through the ADL back to the then apartheid state in South Africa, which I believe exposes to a large degree the Anti-Defamation League, so-called, as a key player in a hypocritical, at the very least, if not a, just a total bad criminal actor in relationship to managing the politics of what we might nowadays call people of color.
Yeah, it's the irony or hypocrisy there is really outstanding. The didn't Israel in the 70s, 80s kind of work with South Africa during some of its illegal arms shipments? I remember reading about some of the illegal arms trading with Iran at the time in the 80s. Wasn't South Africa used as a conduit or a cover?
I know South Africa was used. I know that that there was cooperation between South Africa and Israel regarding nuclear weapons, and I believe that there was I don't really know the full details, but I know there was definitely cooperation in the nuclear area between Israel and South Africa.
It's also interesting because Jewish activism has also been associated with anti-apartheid activism. Joe Slovo, Jewish guy from Poland, Lithuania or Poland, I forget. And so you have this sort of a double game being played here where on one level Jews or these Jewish activists are posing as progressives, critical of apartheid, but then you have outfits like the ADL working with Israeli intelligence to support the apartheid state. It's like,
Yes, and also in terms of the ADL case, it was clear that they were targeting, like, Jeffrey Blankford, who is of Jewish background, but who is a pretty intensely anti-Zionist activist. He was a major target, I guess, and he actually was able to get the files that had been collected on him. Meanwhile, down in L.A., I believe a Palestinian associated activist, I believe of Palestinian background, ended up murdered. And there was never any clear connection to the case in terms of legally proven, but the surrounding aspects of it, where things like blueprints of the office building that this activist worked in were found, and things like the informant having copies of keys, I believe, were a part of the case at the time. So that makes me think about the relationship of intelligence operations to actual what might be called wet operations on the ground. And an interview with the wife, Kay Griggs, the wife of a black ops lieutenant colonel, I believe, George Griggs, Brendan O'Connell has highlighted this a lot, actually, and I think it's very important. She points out that aspects of the SEAL teams have trained with Israeli defense forces, maybe Mossad, wet op teams for years and decades, and almost like there's an exchange of taking out people in other countries on behalf of each other. So that needs to be looked into. And then, of course, that escalation goes all the way up into September 11th and the strong Israeli intelligence networks that are surrounding that event. I guess we're sort of far afoot from the 60s and civil rights.
It's funny, these things all are interrelated, though. That'd be sort of like a version of Murder Incorporated combined with the echelon system where you get someone else to do your dirty work for you, and that way it's technically legal because someone else doing it. It's not our own government doing it, but I think at that level all these intelligence agencies probably Oh, they probably, you know, eat at the same restaurants, date the same girls. You know, it's like that scene in the classic Cold War movie where the American spy meets the Russian spy, and the Russian spy says, "My dear friend, we're getting too old for this business." You know, it's kind of like a kindred spirits at the final analysis. But during your talk on Martin Luther King, both of you addressed something very important. One thing, Greg, kind of got into this idea of the mentioned E. Michael Jones' thesis regarding the slaughter of cities and the use, you know, the exploitation of integration and racial harmony to destroy the ethnic neighborhoods in the North. This was in Chicago, Detroit, in these areas, how these places were intentionally disrupted or destroyed using sort of the threat of integration to destroy the ethnic makeup of these neighborhoods. At the same time, you have the creation of suburbia, interstate highway system, the mass marketing of automobiles. This is a mass social engineering scheme. Might want to, if you want to address that, cause you seem to be familiar with that. And then after you address that, Jeremy, if you could address this notion of black logos versus black iconography, that'd be great.
I've picked up on a lot of I have not read any of Jones's books, but I've picked up on several of his interviews and his Culture Wars article he wrote on the history of the Black Jewish Alliance, and it's a tragic shame when you really consider the implications of what Jones has written about. I don't know if anybody else has written about this and has documented this as in the way that E. Michael Jones has, but it's a tragic shame when you consider all the consequences of this, and that this entire, at the same time as there was this attempt to create integration and to bring in, you know, civil rights and equality, I put those in quotation marks from the perspective of those who are actually, in many ways, are actually shaping the narrative in terms of those in the levers of power. I use those terms in quotation marks. But at the same time as there's this effort for integration and quote-unquote equality, you've got this ongoing effort, kind of a psychological warfare against a lot of these cities where these ethnic neighborhoods are created, where you have people who don't identify by race, but they identify by their ethnicity. And this is one of the points that Jones was pointing out when Martin Luther King went to Chicago. He's being sent up there advised by people like, I believe, Stanley Levison and others to go up to Chicago and basically rabble rouse and tell these neighborhoods that they're racist and that, you know, this racism and bigotry cannot be tolerated. And unlike in the South, where I think identity was mostly determined by race, where you had white and black and whatnot, in these areas, you know, these people, they don't identify by race. They don't identify as white. They identify as Polish. They identify as Lithuanian. Or they identify with their ethnic background. So King coming into these areas and basically being almost manipulated or duped into going into these areas and talking about racism and bigotry, and you have to open your arms to people because if you don't, you're an evil racist. And this is naturally going to create a very hostile reaction, I think, from these groups. But our narrative of history is so distorted that that most people have no understanding or idea. I know I didn't until I started looking into this stuff in the last year and a half or so, that it wasn't just about creating equality. It's about actually the goal of the civil rights movement by those within the positions of power appear to actually have been to perpetuate divide and conquer agenda in the name of creating equality. And it's amazing that so few people have any type of understanding that there was not just a war being waged against the poor black population. There's also wars being waged against these ethnic neighborhoods, and that the forces of integration and civil rights were ultimately used to destroy cohesion in these areas. And I don't know how many people on either side of this whole divide is aware of that. So I think Jones has done extremely important work into breaking this down. I think it's crucial to understanding a lot of the history of the civil rights movement. I think Jeremy can follow up on this by talking about the idea of the black logo. So.
Yeah, one thing for observation with your remarks is, yeah, it's kind of, I think E. Michael Jones, I have read Slaughter of Cities, and I've talked to E. Michael Jones a number of times about that topic, and Yeah, what it was a longstanding social engineering plan based on a fear of Catholic ethnic power. And it was basically a WASP scheme to check Catholic power that was increasing because of what they call differential fertility. And the idea was, how do you get them out of these ethnic neighborhoods where they're impenetrable? They're in love with their parish, and they have this church that they belong to that is outside the WASP establishment, you know, the power structure in the United States. At the same time, this is the Second World War and right after the Cold War project, and how do you get them on board the American Century, Henry Luce's program of American, global domination, which is really Anglo-American zio-global domination. Well, you break them up, you deracinate them, send them into the suburbs, they become white middle class, where they can be subject to psychological warfare of post-war America, consumerism and these things. And with consumerism brings in debt, and this also coincides with the subsequent book, The Barren Metal, the economic warfare that was waged against all classes, particularly because you're talking about different strategies were targeting the white middle class as opposed to the black underclass, but they all in a sense were targeted. And he gets a sense, and I kind of know what he's feeling, is he woke up one day and found that he was part of a vast social engineering experiment, and he wanted to know why, what was happening. And that's when he came upon this stuff. And that's the kind of feeling I get when I read this book. I was like, wow, I wasn't even aware of this. And once you get aware of it, your consciousness shifts and you start having a completely different understanding of the last century. And like you said, the fact that so many people are deracinated, cut off from the ethnic roots, they don't even realize the psychological warfare, which is the most effective psychological warfare because you're not aware of it. It's almost like, does a fish know he's swimming in water? No, it doesn't. So that's an interesting point you make there. Jeremy, I'm sorry.
No, that I'm now thinking through this idea of suburbification in a way, Levittown and the post-World War II rise in the United States of America of a deracinated, as you call it, and we could also, in maybe agricultural terms, we could call it monocultural, mm-hmm. Monoculturing suburbia. And I think there was a sense of that on the earlier side of what King was doing in reference also to what you all mentioned in terms of the 66 campaign to integrate Chicago neighborhoods. I think that after that event, to me, it looks like King moved away from this idea of equality or equal opportunities or equal rights through integration, through actually just seeking equality through the idea of truth and justice. And it looks like that's when he actually got himself into potential trouble with parts of his handlers on the ground, but then also with the depths of the U.S. national security state. And Pepper is actually done interviews with some of the family members of a high-level military intelligence CIA briefer to the president, who, even though he was – I think this is during the Johnson administration, who, while he was briefing Johnson on the war in Vietnam and would always put in a pitch for how immoral and useless the war was, after a while he broke – Johnson down, not enough to end the illegal unjust war, but enough to tell him, I can't end the war because my friends are making too much money. But even that high-level intelligence officer of at least some constitutional conscience, if not moral conscience, ultimately was part of or agreed with the conspiracy to kill King, because those elements were concerned that King was going to be doing activism to bring poor people to Washington, D.C. to recoup basically the funds that had been spent on the war in Vietnam. And when you combine that, what was seen as a really deep threat potentially to even whether that would, if they were turned away from Congress after seeking these checks, I think King talked about we're seeking the check that was promised us, that if that were turned away, then it could turn into a destabilized situation in D.C. and maybe beyond that. But then you also see in terms of the maybe the commanding liberal heights of when, of the year to the day before King was assassinated, the Riverside Church speech, where he really comes out in a strong way publicly against the war in Vietnam in a moral fashion. And he talks, I believe that's the speech where he also talks about how maybe it's not the speech, but he began to talk about how the biggest purveyor of violence in the world was his own government. And it was hard to avoid that fact. In fact, it's still hard to avoid that fact in terms of the continuity of the war of terror in our day and age. But a year to the day before his assassination, going against even some of his fellow black civil rights leaders who said, we need to stay focused on the check that you're talking about civil rights here at home. Why are you making this so confusing with the foreign policy stuff? Sort of like a little bit of paternalism too, I think, sort of like let the liberal whites and Jews handle the foreign policy affairs. Let's just try to get our crumbs and get our chance to escape to the suburbs, I think was part of that. And towards the end of his life, King was very focused on, I think he called them the three pillars of wickedness that he saw, one being militarism, another being racism, but then also poverty. And I think that the evolution of his logical thought and his moral evolution from sort of taking a step back potentially from the setup of reactionary attempts to use political force to integrate neighborhoods, I think that he actually began to develop a maybe even more closer relationship to the logos and the logic of someone like Malcolm X, who in 1994 wrote a interesting, or 1964, he wrote a very interesting article called Zionist Logic in the Egyptian Gazette that talked about the intense and destructive power of Zionist dollarism abroad, but then also seemed to be hinting at the way that it could be used to compromise black movements around the world. And I think that King began to move in his logic and then in the form of his logos, being a mouthpiece for certain aspects of black aspiration, American aspiration. He began to move closer towards a Malcolm X position where he wasn't he didn't feel dependent upon trying to integrate himself or what he saw as his people into a suburbanified post-World War II America. So then he was taken out. And what you see then is, in the wake of that, you see in some ways the beginning of the replacement of these leaders like X, Malcolm X, who of course was also assassinated years earlier in 65. And then both of the Kennedy brothers, John and Robert, and then King in 68. That you see the replacement of these characters of some logos with something more like iconography. And the part of that, of course, is the rise of the Black Panthers, and they incorporate a lot of the logos into their iconography. But it was clear that iconography was a key piece of it. The famous photos with the shotguns and and there was a lot of logos behind that in terms of self-defense.
Yeah, is it Newton who's in the rattan chair?
Yes, Huey yeah. Newton. That famous photo of Huey Newton in the chair, sort of looking like an African American warrior prince of some sort. And I think that was very important for African American pride. An idea of self-defense in a dignified and regal fashion, and the combination of the standing on Second Amendment self-defense rights, plus the creation of lunch programs and trying to feed the children in their community so they would have good food for their growing bodies. That was a very powerful example. But in some ways, it had evolved or devolved in some ways into iconography that ultimately then literally got pimped out into the icon of the pimp. And Tim, I think you're pretty familiar with this aspect, right, of the Time Life photographer who used his black skin color to infiltrate himself into the Black Panthers.
Gordon Parks, yeah.
Yeah, Gordon Parks, who comes straight out of the Time Life magazine, loose psychological warfare capacity, and something that just popped in my mind there is this figure of C.D. Jackson, who's a key figure in that mode, who is one of the key people in proposing the post-World War II narrative of the camps, the concentration camps, what ultimately became termed the Holocaust, even though it was called in Jewish terms Shoah, which is a much more historical term in relationship to suffering rather than burnt offering specifically. But C.D. Jackson was a key player there, and it turns out his actual name was C.D. Jacobson. And I found that out in an interesting article about the Dakota Hotel, where he seems to be – he obviously tried to hide his Jewishness at some level, and he was asking questions about how many Jews were in the hotel. And so that's just an aside. That's an interesting figure in all of this, I think, in terms of this Time Life mind war complex. But when you think about the unraveling, the COINTELPRO, the purposeful disruption of these powerful black iconographical images of the Black Panthers in the 60s and into the 70s, you then see the rise of the pimp film, the pimp iconography. What's the name of this Time Life photographer again?
Gordon Parks.
Gordon Parks. He was key to that. The film. What's the originating film?
There
Shaft.
There is Shaft, and then there is what was the other one? He did Shaft, and his son actually was brought in to do Superfly.
Uh huh.
Yeah.
So then you begin to – I see a continuity of agenda in many ways too, where that becomes the celebration of the disintegration and the dislocation of strong black Christian communities in many ways, and where someone is celebrated for their willingness to pimp out their own people, to do violence, to keep them in line as sort of an enforcer, a selling off of the sexuality of the black woman. And that then continues and actually gets escalated while being pushed back against by other elements into the era of the crack cocaine epidemics of the 1980s, the Reagan era, but the rise of hip hop. And you see things like the Public Enemy, who to this day represent some of the most highly informed and articulate members of the Black Logos, I think, that are still out there, where you have Chuck D in some way is sort of like the king of the Martin Luther King of hip hop, and then there's the intelligence czar of Public Enemy, Professor Griff. He's sort of more the Malcolm X of the black hip hop logos in certain ways. But at the very same time, you see the rise of the gangster rap, iconography through things like NWA, which still held a little bit of value in terms of journalism and news reporting from the ghettos of South Central LA in a certain way. But then that was then used as a springboard to pimp out gangster culture and sold off you know, by the record executives, in many cases, a lot of them, you know, Jewish oligarch types.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of the crack cocaine, of course, this figures into MENA, Arkansas, coming in from South, you know, from Central America. This funded the counter operation. This is the, a lot of the proceeds are actually laundered through the Arkansas Development Finance Corporation, which is used to finance the growth of Tyson Foods and Walmart. And this
ironically,
yeah, this folds in. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say Tyson, I think, figures very much into the Dixie Mafia in Memphis, which was very much operating in Memphis in 68. So
that's right. It was Carlos Marcella, that outfit. But that, yeah, I mean, that's interesting. This notion of sort of the psychological or cultural aggression that was waged against the black community in the 1960s under the guise of integration, at least simultaneous with civil rights and these things, at this very time that the black population of the United States seems to be getting civil rights and getting access to rights and privileges, right to vote and these things, the family, the beleaguered black family is being obliterated, I'd argue, by things like welfare, which actually cuckold young black men and actually subsidized the breakup of the black family. There's this culture war being waged against them via Hollywood, MGM, the black exploitation films. And E. Michael Jones actually wrote a very long piece about the connections between CIA, Time Life, and James Aubrey, who headed MGM at the time. And when you're talking about CIA, we're not just talking about CIA proper language. We're talking about the corporate structure. You know, that really is the CIA. That also is the movie industry, and Hollywood itself as sort of a weapon, a culture in the culture war, and it's sort of its role in degrading culture in the United States, not just blacks but also just whites too, just through, you know, the sexualization of things. And then that factors into the breakup of the neighborhoods, because for the longest time the production code was enforced. Largely because you had these ethnic neighborhoods that that formed the backbone for the political power of the Catholic Church, as also cultural power, and it was in the mid-60s that it collapsed, largely from a function that the fact by the mid-60s these urban neighborhoods had been destroyed and suburbia had sprouted up with a bunch of deracinated Catholics who were no longer organized or conscious of their ethno-religious identity. So the Catholic Church could no longer put the restraints in Hollywood. And so that factors in. It's a big factor into the culture war. And it is.
I wanted to say,
go ahead.
I think you and Joe Atwell in some of your programs have taken it a step further as far as this whole cultural agenda. And you've even put in, as opposed on the other side of the, you know, black exploitation, rise of the pimp culture, you've also got, say, for example, disco music, which was kind of almost was marketed, I think, to both white and black populations as being another element of cultural warfare.
So. Yeah, it was I think Joe, that was funny. He's disco is a conspiracy designed to make white men look ridiculous. Because we just don't dance. I'm sorry.
and to dumb down some of the best of American music that was sort of making its way.
That's right.
Forward in a way, in a certain way, you know, that you could see I see jazz and hip hop as creative and constructive, very deeply beautiful responses. To taking up an art form in a uniquely African American position in time and place, and really making a lot of possibility there. And so the destruction or the degradation or the devolution of something like jazz into disco or from hip hop, which is sort of actually formed in many ways out of the crack laden ghettos surrounding New York City when there was a destruction of the music programs and there was no musical instruments. So back, you know, decades earlier, there were actually musical instruments. So kids, even if they were poor, they actually had access to a musical instrument. So they became a jazz musician. But in the sort of late 70s with the heroin epidemic in the wake of the Golden Triangle and Vietnam into the Iran-Contra crack cocaine 80s of the looting of creative programs and cultural programs, then kids in the ghettos of New York City were basically left to picking their parents' record players and mix and learning how to sample. And it's so interesting too that hip hop comes in many ways. Some people will degrade it by saying it's sample music and it's basically it's a degraded art form because the artists don't play their own instruments, and that in some cases is not even true, and there are actual hip hop bands. But even in the case of sampled music, that represents a highly creative approach, even I would say in some ways out of the Black Logos to the difficulty of their economic moment in a way, and taking samplers and being able to create any kind of instrument by sampling some of the best American recordings of the 70s, which had a very high level of engineering behind it, both in terms of the musicality but also the recording engineering. And so in some ways you see that as a very powerful art form that then very quickly gets taken over and then pimped out and sort of sold out to the highest bidder in many ways. And you continue to have such figures as people like Tupac Shakur, who it looks like was another figure with he had his own struggles. He was a complex character in many ways, but he also evolved, and he had a very high quotient of Black Logos that I think was threatening to certain powers that be. And there is evidence that he was also then taken out by some of those networks.
Yeah, because he was apparently trying to establish a peace between the Crips and the Bloods. And if you look at how it works, is the Crips and the Bloods are street level act. Well, soldiers are proxies for the banks who use those areas to market guns and drugs. And also a cultural, sort of an opium war strategy to degrade those neighborhoods. I think probably not just for the purposes of genocide, but also for the purposes of gentrification. That seems to be a strategy. That also factors into the production, the creation of the privatized prison system and the exploitation of labor, sort of an imposition of de facto slavery again through the criminal justice system. And the drugs play a big part of that too, because it entraps the Black population. The police have something over their heads, and they can crack down wherever they want, and it's very useful. That's why one of the reasons why drugs are imported into those areas. An interesting point is, I was reading a recent article by E. Michael Jones talking, eight years in power, I guess a retrospective on the Obama administration and some of these Black activists. And the role that this goes into what we're talking about, these sort of the moral degradation of the Black community, the promotion of sexual promiscuity, and sort of a deadly cycle of despair this creates. Because what happens is when you have the sort of collapse of the nuclear family in the Black community, no fathers around. I mean, you're familiar with the Temptations song, Papa Was a Rolling Stone. Papa was a rolling stone, wherever he laid his hat was his home, and when he died, all he left us was alone. Papa was a rolling stone. That's 1972 by the Temptations. So this sort of despair, it was all around even in the early 70s. But after the 1960s, you get the collapse of the Black family, and this is because the sexual revolution. What this does is it creates a cycle where Black children no longer have fathers around. They're living primarily with mothers, and the mothers are on welfare, and they're bringing in boyfriends, and this creates a cycle where the kids are subject to physical abuse, the daughters often sexual abuse, and you know, this destroys their lives. And they, what do? They in, out of despair. What do you, what do? You go out and you just recreate that same cycle. And this is the rates of sexual abuse in the black community are much higher than it is in the white community because of the breakdown of the family itself. The children don't have the benefit of a specific father they're genetically related to. They don't have a stable home, and he equates a lot of the tendency of black activists in the 70s and 80s and since to continue blaming whitey for their problems is because they don't want to address the sexual problems in their lives and the fact that there's no father around, which is a much bigger problem for blacks than it is not being able to vote. I mean, in the 1950s, blacks couldn't vote, but they had a father. And if you look in that environment in the from 1945 to 1963, all the measures, all the index we use for upward mobility, they were improving for blacks. And it was in the era of the civil rights when they supposed to get all these rights that it started to collapse for the black family, for blacks. And they've had the stagnation since then. Now you have 75-80% illegitimacy rates. I mean, it's a disaster.
Well, I think that certainly the idea of getting to vote, and obviously voting is a very powerful instrument that every American should be able to practice in good hopes and spirits, and that we're making something happen. But of course, the problem is that we get the option to vote for criminals. So, I mean, you give people the freedom to vote for criminals. And so there's a major problem there. But I'm going to make a point about the Obama presidency, and this will tie back into what you just said. But I think there was a very powerful article that pretty much shaped up America under Obama, the state of black America under Obama, and in general, I think, in a lot of ways. And it was published on blackagendareport.com, mm-hmm. which I would highly recommend. Very good voice of consciousness out there, I believe. The article was titled "Loretta Lynch is Condoleezza Rice with a Law Degree." This is referring to Obama's attorney general. In this article, it goes into detail about how Loretta Lynch never once, during all of her years as a high-powered attorney, prosecutor, never once went after any type of major banks or actual people with power, or she never defended anyone who actually was in a vulnerable position. Her entire career was spent defending people in positions of power, banks, and of that persuasion. And this writer, this article, ties it into the how, honestly, the civil rights movement was never intended to actually create equality, but the conclusion of this article was that civil rights and later on affirmative action were designed to put black faces into positions of power, the same, to serve the same establishment that the white establishment has served for so long. So you're not actually getting any real upward mobility. You're getting a few people put into positions of power that are going to serve the same structure that the white establishment serves, the same structure that has been putting its boot down on the poor black community for so long. And in that context, though, you don't get any real actual type of uplifting or mobility or any type of real social mobility in any way. Rather, what you're getting, there's really no progress being made. Rather, what you're getting is you're getting a few faces. You're putting a black face or a Latino face or an Asian face on this same establishment that has been in power for so long. And one of the problems of this is that you're not addressing these very real problems. And a lot of people would say that it's racist or it's sexist or whatever. You're a bigot of some type to even address these issues related to how sexuality works with all of these with the state of our society. And I'm not one of these people who's like, I wouldn't consider myself, I'm not real passionate on, say, a lot of these social issues, but I can see where cohesion is needed and there is a need for stability to an extent in our society. And when you lose sight of that through a lot of this artificial, fake, pseudo progress being made in these communities where what you're simply getting is you're getting a few people who are going to rise up to positions of prominence, serve the same structure that has been hurting you forever, rather than actually elevating and uplifting the people in your community, that is, I think, a major, major issue that needs to be taken into consideration. And there definitely is a factor related to sexuality and morality that needs to be addressed in all of this. And it's very difficult to get that message out.
Well, I mean, sex tends to produce children, and children need to be cared for. And if your father is indeed a Rolling Stone, you're going to be handicapped throughout life.
And one of the problems with replacing the Logos, which stands on its own because it justifies itself through logic and through thinking through things and standing for things, with replacing the Logos with the icon or the iconography. In some ways, you can see this as the from the murders of Martin King and Malcolm X to the rise of people like Jesse Jackson and then the first black president, Barack Obama, who has the iconography of a stable black father family in the White House. But in terms of the actual policy, a lot of it is a cipher or empty iconography. Mm-hmm. But it's even can be worse because then you can have not only empty iconography than full Logos, but you can actually get things like what we might call toxic mimics in that are presented with a shiny sheen to them. And that is sort of what you were talking about that happened in relationship not only to the black community, but also if you think about it with the role of something like MK Ultra at a very high level in relationship to something like 60s counterculture and the predominantly white and Jewish hippie movement, where the rising idea of a logos of activism that was against war, that was deliberative democratic principles and egalitarian possibilities, these types of things, was replaced with things like hippie free love and drugs in many ways.
Yeah, that's so it was Bert Schneider who produced the Easy Rider.
Oh, I didn't know. And so a similar type of thing happens in relationship to the black community, although it played its way out in a different way because the drugs were different, right? The drugs were a little more downers than the sort of psychedelics of the white Jewish hippie culture in a certain way. But then the sexual promiscuity aspect of the pimp culture, mm-hmm. and as you pointed out, the use is of drugs as a weapon, of course, is hundreds of years old, not only opium wars but even probably before that. But it's very important to understand in a certain way because it is not only that it destroys the fiber of the home just literally because then fathers are arrested and then are put in prison and are not there with their family. But then even the CIA psychiatrist Jolyon West, who was the manager of most patsies that you can think of the last half of the 20th century, including people like the accused Oklahoma City bomber. What was his name again?
Timothy McVeigh.
Mm-hmm. He made a point that the drugs were a perfect tool of the state because not only did they destabilize people who took them, but just the holding of them, the possibility of creating a police state apparatus, destabilized everyone who was in the vicinity of them socially or even physically in a political fashion. That meant that the police state could literally break down your door at any moment, no matter whether you were living in the black inner city or you were in a hippie commune with LSD. So that was very decentering and destabilizing, I think, aspect of the insertion of drugs into lots of different communities that was probably intentional.
Yeah, and you also have just the image here, the optics of the situation, if you want to talk about manipulation, because this is getting back to the late 60s, the appeal to the silent majority, Nixon's silent majority. I'm not just blaming Nixon for this. All politicians do this, but became known as Nixon because of the 68 campaign that got him elected over Hubert Humphrey, was a revulsion of large sections of the white middle class to the 60s counterculture, and this became associated with anti-war, as if you couldn't be a respectable middle class, have a job, have a family, a car payment and be anti-war. You have to be pro-war. That's the dialectic. The same way that the infusion of drugs, the promotion of sex in the black communities, in the melt of the black family, would create a violent situation. A lot of examples of violent stories coming out of the black ghettos that would again create fear and revulsion among the white middle class. And this tends to divide society, have people choose sides in these things, which is why now you either have to be pro-cop and indifferent to black suffering, or you have to be anti-cop and be indifferent to the high crime rates that are so among black men, particularly black men. When actually, they're both these problems coexist and they actually feed off one another.
Sounds like a Masonic checkerboard of options to me.
So we're back again.
We mentioned the Southern strategy and Nixon, and Trump and the people around him have so expertly followed up on this with the dog whistling to the white groups, of course, mm-hmm. and to, I guess, white conservative white America, with using the NFL as a platform to promote basically borderline military worship and worship of all things related to military and law enforcement. And very much just like in the 60s, if you opposed the war in any way, shape, or form, or if you started to point out realities of things that the U.S. military were doing in Southeast Asia, then you're un-American, America-hating, communist. And it's the same way now, whereas if you oppose if you don't think that football players kneeling during the national anthem, although I think that they ultimately might be getting steered in the wrong direction with a lot of the meaning for that, because I think there's a lot of reasons to not stand and salute the flag during the national anthem. But if you don't for any reason, then you're the equivalent of the most evil person walking the face of the earth, because you're not pro-law enforcement, you're not pro-military, and therefore you're anti-Americana. And so I think currently situation where it's been so expertly exploited by Trump and his people, very much the same way it was in the late 60s. And now, of course, on top of that, you've got Antifa and you've got the threat of radical Islam to scare these people, that they're all one in the same with the anti-American crowd who opposes law, who's critical of law enforcement, aspects of law enforcement. They're all one in the same and they're all interchangeable. And so very much you're seeing a parallel there. And Americana and Americanism and patriotism is very narrowly defined to fit these, in many ways, criminal institutions that we have been, in so many ways, conditioned to believe are the greatest, are our greatest institutions and things that we must support no matter what.
Oh, yeah, the NFL itself and its alliance with the military, with recruitment, yep, commercials. And people forget that. I think it was as recently as 8 years ago, there never was, they didn't have a national anthem. The players didn't come out to after the national anthem had been sung. So this is a relatively new thing that the NFL did, supposedly with the military, to boost recruitment, yeah, the military.
And baseball did the same thing after the after September 11th, began to subtly replace Take Me Out to the Ball Game with God Bless America during the 17th stretch.
And then you have, of course, the whole military thing where now every so often, you know, I think of Memorial Day, the players wear fatigue jerseys.
Oh, wow. Yeah,
and it's all militarized. Yeah, it's, you know.
And it is the case. It's so interesting, too, that the with all of the hype around the kneeling in NFL in the age of Trump, that, yes, that I do think that that program, that propaganda program funded and backed by the Pentagon for recruitment and propaganda purposes was started, I think, in the first year of the Obama administration. Yep. So the Trump people who, you know, see Obama as the arch figure of Satan should probably be commending the people that are going against that Obama policy. And in a certain way, though, the larger aspect of this is that we can begin to see the replacement of the rich and organic and loving archetypes and icons of the mother and the father in some ways being replaced by these highly violent and negatively subversive grouping of the mother has become this media that is is selling you horrible images of yourself and of no hope or possibility for your own power and responsibility for your own world. And then the toxic father image is this warfare state mm-hmm. of some sort. And then and even hearkening back to the drug rise of drug culture and the absence of black fathers and black fathers in jail. At that point, then you see the logical option that then is presented in an intense fashion is the father welfare state, the toxic father image welfare state that's backed up by this so-called national security state that it has a supremacist aspect to it and organized to kill the black leaders so that you're inherently compromised in a certain way. So that's another part about this that underlies a lot of this is this idea of moral compromise. And I think we're seeing more and more of that in the age of Trump in a certain way in relationship specifically to this idea of patriotism being corrupted and being compromised by the all of these dark and shady connections that are becoming obvious behind the scenes.
Yeah, and I'll make one more real quick point about that is that when, you know, I went to a majority non-white high school, and I remember there being military recruiters everywhere on my high school campus. And what I think that demonstrates, and this was right around the time the Iraq War was starting, the first few years of the war, and what I think that demonstrates is that very much even this culture is – it's sold just as much to poor, I think non-whites in inner cities as it is sold to white America, this whole idea of the military is your hope and your way out. And it's actually an avenue for you to kind of escape poverty and escape a lot of the terrible things that are going on in your communities. And so I think that was a very powerful tool. And it's interesting in a way that there's so much consciousness around in some aspects around the evils of law enforcement, the excesses of law enforcement. But at the same time, you're being put into the same culture where you have this, I think, overriding respect and maybe not as much of a borderline military worship as you'll find like in conservative white America, but it's still there, whereas the military and these institutions are sold as kind of a way out of the other options you have facing you as a young person in a poor inner city area. So,
yeah, the intentional destruction of these cities in the middle of the 20th century, coupled with the deindustrialization that occurred after 1973, and this happened goes I think is a consequence of the collapse of the Bretton Woods system, the rise of the petrodollar, and the creation of the U.S. dollar as a world reserve currency. This led to the deindustrialization because it led to a situation where U.S. Exports were more expensive and imports were subsidized, and so inevitably this was going to lead to factories going abroad. And this I alluded to it earlier with this deal with Walmart. Walmart, you know, this deal was struck at the very time David Rockefeller was getting China, setting up China to be this industrial or productions manufacturing giant, which now a lot of the goods that fill this, most of the goods that fill this, the shelves of Walmart are made in China, not in the United States. And that's also this time when wages stagnated, and they were kind enough to bring in the credit card to make up for the lost wages. This gets in the issue of usury and how what the long term effects of usury is an inordinate concentration of wealth in a few hands. And that gets us towards maybe the ultimate goal, which is some sort of a neo form of neo feudalism. And this is why the middle class is being squeezed so hard now, because the jobs aren't there anymore for the middle class. And so they're making up the difference with borrowing. They've roped so many, they've tricked so many young people thinking that college is the way out or the way to maintain your middle class mediocrity. So you go to college, you borrow outrageous sums to get a degree, and you graduate, and there's no job for you other than maybe you're being a barista or working at Home Depot or something. But you're perpetually in debt. And there doesn't seem to be any way out. This leads to this despair. And ultimately, this also helps recruitment in the military, because that's one way out. Right? I mean, it's like Rome. It's like Rome in the 3rd or 4th century, where the army has to grow but to defend the empire, but the expense of the army destroys the empire, destroys any loyalty to the empire, which then results in a sort of a resurgence of ethnic consciousness among, you know, the Goths or these things that were brought in to buttress the empire. And you get this collapse, which then ultimately led to this Saint Benedict, you know, and he decided, you know, the Benedictine order and these things, and this led to the creation of Christendom in Europe. So who knows how these things turn out? But again, we're dealing with a society which I think succumbed to economic nominalism. That no one really thinks about the long-term effects of these things, or even has the sophistication to think about it. Very few do, and they're just trying to you know, live day by day just to get by, to deal with the increasing expenses of everyday life. But if you look at you look at the malevolence of high finance and malevolence of high politics and high finance, how it is there to crush everybody except the 1% or the 1%, and that's something we're faced with today. But it, going back to Martin Luther King and the Civil Rights Movement, it's interesting. He's assassinated April 5th, 1968, in Memphis, Tennessee.
Fourth,
I'm sorry. But he was pretty much an asset or a tool of the establishment, because his activism, I think they were happy with him when he was going throughout the South stirring up trouble in the South, because that served the interest of the oligarchs. Because they don't mind, you know, picking on the South. That had been, you know, the North has been doing that for the better part of a century, I guess you could say. But you can always pick on the South's problems. And then if you focus on the South's problems, that makes the North look good. Although most of the riots were in the North, which is kind of telling, in the 1960s. So there were race problems in the North. He doesn't seem to become a target. He doesn't become targeted for assassination until he starts to take on the Vietnam War and the National Security State, which is interesting.
Yes, and march and sort of going to D.C.,
mm-hmm.
going to the swamp rather than the South or the middle of the country.
Yeah.
And what's interesting, too, there is Pepper has information that some of the military intelligence groups that were running some of the behind the scenes backup for some of the snipers who actually took him didn't actually kill him. And actually, it's an interesting story that he was actually killed by the main doctor to the Dixie mob, who actually put a pillow over his face in the specific hospital they took him to, and then they spit it on him and called him the N-word when they left the room. But Pepper has information that the assassination teams were actually set up in Los Angeles for months before, and that they were actually going to take out Robert Kennedy and King, both in Los Angeles. So in a certain way, you can actually think of the shift of the operation to Memphis, Tennessee, as not only making it less suspicious of taking out these two high-profile people in the middle of Los Angeles, and close to Hollywood, by the way, but instead taking out King more in a place of the South. And definitely not associated with the District of Columbia. So I think there is something to that it was the minute that he began to sort of turn around towards the commanding heights of the power centers that were behind him in certain ways, and trying to manage some of his movements, and begin to march towards them, that he did get the crosshairs put upon him.
Yeah, because we talk a little about the assassination. His assassination, I think, is, I guess you could say, as controversial as Robert Kennedy's or even JFK's. People who have analyzed, William Pepper, of course, has written three books on it, I think. But the most recent is The Plot to Kill King. But before that, he had an act of state. And he pretty much, I think, makes a strong case that, of course, there was a patsy there. James Earl Ray could not have been the assassin, and I guess he thinks there was a sharpshooter for the Memphis police that pulled the trigger, and James Earl Ray was set up to take the heat, take the hit for it. I mean, get the blame for it. Do you want to get in a little of that? Some of the intrigues of the assassination down there, and
Sure. And he actually, it's interesting because he knew King for the last maybe year of his life or something like that. And King supposedly found out about Pepper by Pepper's writing about Vietnam, being on the ground and documenting some of the war crimes that he witnessed there. And so in a certain way, Pepper actually was partially responsible for the growth of King's consciousness around war and empire in a
Pepper
certain way.
Told a story, Pepper told a story of how after he saw Pepper's article in Ramparts magazine with the children of Vietnam and all these pictures of these young people who were suffering under the U.S. military at the time in this war. And King had told one of his confidants, I can never enjoy another meal again until this war is ended. And that was in direct response to William Pepper's article in Ramparts magazine. So.
Yeah. And, and one of the criticisms, you know, you hear the alt-right criticism of Martin Luther King is because he was a womanizer, and then you have this FBI report about his, you know, being involved in orgies and maybe perhaps misusing of Ford Foundation funds, although I think the Ford Foundation probably didn't care about that. But, the Ford Foundation was there creating, just like the Ford Foundation backs La Raza, it's there to create trouble, you know, whatever. The notion... you know, I've read some of his criticisms that King was supporting the communists in Vietnam, as if the war in Vietnam had anything to do about containing communism. Come on, guys. Uh-huh. I think King's reaction to Vietnam was genuine.
I think so too. Yeah. I think it seemed to fit within his moral Christian framework in a way. And the other thing, though, in terms of like we don't know the truth about about King's private actions. We do know the FBI it's on documentation that one of their ways that they would sow discord was by creating lies about people telling other people.
Exactly. This is why I read these reports. I'm like, this is the FBI. Is J. Edgar Hoover going to lecture Martin Luther King about sexual morality? But go ahead. You have this assassination. You know, you read the details of the assassination. Just like here we go again. It's like Robert F. Kennedy's assassination. James Earl Ray, his lawyer set him up. Told him to plea out. And said, because I couldn't give you adequate defense, and this will be grounds for a retrial. He never got that retrial. It was always rejected. There was a trial, I think a civil trial in 1999, where Lord Jowers, one of the conspirators, admits that he was part of a conspiracy. Therefore, the official narrative, based on his confession, is blown out of the water. But Pepper, identified this guy, Raoul, this gunrunner, CIA spook type, which apparently set Ray up. Because Ray had... Ray apparently had been allowed to break out of prison the year before.
Yes, yeah. And this Raoul character is a key figure that ties a lot of this together. Not only the King and the John Kennedy assassination, but also the U.S. intelligence to Israeli intelligence networks. And I guess Pepper's identified him as Raoul Coelho, who was an ex-Portuguese intelligence operative of some sort. And people should actually, it's very interesting. Michael Collins Piper, the late Michael Collins Piper, who wrote Final Judgment about the Israeli and Jewish crime involvement in the John Kennedy assassination. There's an interesting video on YouTube that has been attacked, apparently. It's very difficult to share. There's a border there. But if you type in things like Martin Luther King assassination, Mossad, or Israel, you'll get a 10-minute video that points out some of the interesting connections between this Raoul character, who was the handler for the King assassination of Patsy James Earl Ray, and I believe Jacob Rubenstein, the killer of the Patsy in the case of the Kennedy. And there's this interesting axis that I believe also potentially ties into the Anti-Defamation League, where you see an axis running from New Orleans up to Montreal. And the Bronfmans are very much in the mix there. And just popped in my mind is I just discovered that the first DCI, Director of Central Intelligence, intelligence was a man named Sewers, I think his name is. Is that right?
Sowers?
I think that's right. Yeah.
Sowers. I think Sowers.
Yes. And yeah. This was like proto CIA. This is when it was the Central Intelligence Group, and Truman named him. And I believe that he actually comes from this Piggly Wiggly store in Missouri. And but if you actually go look into his background, I found the encyclopedia of the CIA PDF online. And you go into his background, and his background is down in New Orleans as a journalist. But then he's managing the port of New Orleans and these types of things. And then I looked into it, and it looks like this is a Jewish name too. So I think it's very interesting that we've never heard the possibility that the very first director of Central Intelligence in the United States of America was tied into this New Orleans group, and also was a potentially a Jewish Midwesterner.
Very interesting. That's very interesting. Wow. Have you ever connected a few years later, you had the attempt on Governor Wallace when he was running for the presidency, and Arthur Bremer, who I think this is another interesting with Arthur Bremer again, another, if you look at his, he had like unexplained financing. He was able to stay at 5-star hotels and things like that. So it's just like one of these cases. To a Sirhan Sirhan, who I believe his sister worked at the stables where Sirhan Sirhan was a jockey. If I have that correct, detail correct.
Wow,
which is very interesting. Quite another
very interesting
another coincidence.
And just by real quickly, Greg, this link between James Earl Ray's handler Raul and Jack Ruby was apparently running weapons in 1963, arms smuggling stolen weapons from the U.S. military bases and funneling them to Israel. So this network that specifically is part of this. And then the other thing that popped in my mind here too is that thing, that story about Johnson on the eve of the 67 war in Israel, being with apparent Irgun Mossad agent Matilda Krim is her name?
Krim? Yeah, Matilda Krim, yeah.
Yeah, and then that, of course, hooks right into the Hollywood scene. Her husband, I believe, was a bigwig in the Hollywood scene. So these networks are right there. Okay, sorry about that, Greg.
Of course, and of course, we know how Johnson responded to the USS Liberty and the deliberate attack on that, along with such figures, of course, as John McCain's father, Admiral McCain. But this is another interesting point that I think is actually pretty significant when you think about it. There's video of Judge Joe Brown, the TV judge. He's very well rounded on a lot of these issues as far as what's going on in terms of the political system and I think a lot of the moral bankruptcy of a lot of the African-American establishment. He's been on record in an interview saying that he was originally scheduled to be the judge for the Ray retrial, and that he never ended up getting to be the judge for that. And he very much is of the belief that James Earl Ray was not the killer, and was describing multiple assassins. And so that's very interesting that the TV judge Joe Brown, who is very much, I think, very awake in a lot of areas, was never got to be the judge for this Ray trial that he was scheduled to be.
Look at James Earl Ray. He had no history of being a violent criminal. He was a burglar, I thought, a thief. He had no racial history. I mean, he had no racial animus. In fact, I think reading about him, he actually got along well with like the blacks in the jail and everything. And he apparently was allowed to escape, and then I guess like bankrolled by Raul. Sort of like, that's what it looks like to me. And given jobs like gun running for him in the year in between his escape in 1967 and the assassination in 1968, he had a new Mustang, like a 1967 Mustang. How did he get that? Then he drives up to Canada, makes his way to England, and he's about to fly out to England to Algeria, I think, or something. This is a two-bit hood. I mean, a two-bit criminal. How is he getting away with all this? And of course, he had no marksmanship skills at all. Right? I mean,
yes. And Pepper, apparently in the civil case, was able to prove, and of course, we're not talking about criminal law. It was a civil suit. So we're not talking about beyond a reasonable doubt, I don't think. I think we're talking about an evidence strain of clear and convincing. And apparently it took the jury less than an hour to quickly decide. And what's even more interesting is that the media, including court TV, was supposed to cover it. And everyone left. And you still barely hear of it. And what's interesting is Pepper identifies, like, why won't the so-called progressives such as Amy Goodman, Noam Chomsky, and Bill Moyers cover these assassinations from the 60s? I found this in a court, let alone talking about September 11th and that whole thing. But in this case, I believe that Pepper was able to actually show the layers of governmental involvement, both in terms of the local Memphis Police Department sharpshooter who was practicing on the range that morning, but also at the state level of Tennessee, but then also all the way to the federal government. And apparently it was the FBI that was arranging the setup for this, which included things like Pepper has a witness to one Jesse Jackson getting delivered bags of money, apparently, from FBI networks for snitching on King and other aspects of the civil rights movement.
And he's the one.
In addition to that,
go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, in addition to that, I believe Pepper lays out evidence that Jesse Jackson was directly involved in getting Martin Luther King's hotel room switched from a lower floor to a higher floor so that he would be more vulnerable.
Yeah, I was about to say that. Yeah, so yeah, exactly. Yeah, and of course, then there's also the presence of the 902nd Battalion there at the on top of the fire station that was following King. Perhaps they're the backup. And there's an good interview with Ryan Dawson and Doug Valentine regarding the King assassination. And Doug Valentine kind of breaks down what's going on in Memphis at the time, the context. This is the context of the sanitation strike, worker strike, which were all black at the time. And how the police work at the local level with the mob to manage the drug trade to keep the black population down by drugs, like we mentioned earlier. You know, the Jolly and West quote, more or less, is being played out. But, this is how it would play out in Memphis, how the police do work with the mob, and so does the CIA, and so does the FBI. These things are all managed.
And even more in the day after, in the days after September 11th, when we have the rise of Homeland Security, Michael Chertoff, the fusion centers, the first fusion center, I believe, was formed in the outskirts of Los Angeles by one William Bratton, who was the police chief of New York City. And then became police chief of Los Angeles and is now back towards New York City. But he also worked with things like Kroll Incorporated, which was key to the actual human so-called security layer at the World Trade Center in the wake of the black operation of the 93 World Trade Center bombing, all the way up through the total destruction on September 11th. So it is these layers and it's usually sort of a one-way operation. And so the rise of the fusion center, although the local police think that they're getting tasty little tidbits in a certain way from NSA probably transcripts, and it's being fed to them by certain fusion center people very likely, and then they use it in what's called parallel construction because it's against the Fourth Amendment for them to actually be directly using it. In exchange for that, for them to be able to increase their conviction rates, they're also being very much directed in, I would say, an anti-American and anti-constitutional fashion, and being sold a bill of goods and disinformation from the top on down. And then in addition to this network, in terms of the sort of federal down through the state and local law enforcement and its intelligence networks, there's also the connection of intelligence agencies to what we might call what's sort of been sort of frequently called the deep state now. And the actual terminology of the deep state coming out of Peter Dale Scott's investigations has to do with where the national security apparatus links in to the criminal underworld, the mob scene. And so this is also at play. And actually, there's two pieces of information that maybe tie into that Piper actually mentioned in this video. And one is that James Earl Ray actually wrote a book. It was called Who Killed Martin Luther King? And he claims that one David Graver traveled with Ray's handler, Raul, and David Graver apparently was part of the looting through the American Bank and Trust Company of New York, which was previously the Swiss Israel Trade Bank, which was founded by Tibor Rosenbaum, who anybody who's read mm-hmm. Final Judgment knows that this is the Permindex Mossad linked to the Kennedy assassination. One other thing was that there was two phone numbers that Ray was given by his handler, Raul, who of course had this relationship of gun running to Israel with Jacob Rubenstein, who of course also hooked into the Mickey Cohen, Meyer Lansky, mob network into LA and Hollywood in many ways. And one of these numbers, this is quoting Piper on this: the resident listed in New Orleans was, among other things, an agent at a Middle East organization distressed because of King's reported forthcoming before his death public support of the Palestinian Arab cause, unquote. Here's another quote: he intended, like Vietnam, to support the Arab cause. Someone in his organization making contact with the Palestinians for an alliance. So this is pretty interesting. What is this organization down there in New Orleans that was one of the phone numbers given to the patsy of the King assassination by his handler? It sort of sounds like it might be the Anti-Defamation League.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Wow. And of course, you mentioned the fusion centers, and the fusion centers themselves, the prototype for the fusion center was actually conceived in the context or within the Phoenix program in Vietnam.
That's a great article by Douglas Valentine, yeah, about the Homeland Security and the Phoenix program. Yes.
And so how this would, again, we see that. And also, I think one of the advisors was Wolf.
Marcus Wolf.
Wolf, the Stasi. He's the advisor.
Yeah, the Homeland Security is advised by Marcus Wolf, Stasi, and then the KGB, Kalugin, right?
Yeah. Which they, yeah, you know, like I said, that I think at the final analysis, all these people are all the same type, same caliber of people are in.
You know, it's interesting. I didn't mean to cut you off, Tim.
No, go ahead. I was just.
It's interesting when you just like with so many other issues, whether it's related to finance, you know, what you might call controlled opposition. Whether, once again, the thing that's important to do is, I always realize that you don't always have to have all of these specific details on exactly what happened when, but if you can connect the dots together and trace people and groups back to other to major power levers of power, then in all of these cases you can always connect somebody to some major lever of power, and that's the common bond that I think ties all of these things together, is tying people and their connections to various assassinations or false flag style attacks or psychological operations or whatnot, and tracing their background, where they come from, who they've been associated with.
Yeah, and I don't know if for a lot of these participants, I don't know if they're even aware of a particular agenda. But it's sort of like I'm reading Daniel Hopsicker's Barry and the Boys. I finally forked out the money and bought it. and he's making the point about the intrigues leading up to the Castro revolution in 1959. And he's talking about Barry Seal and David Ferry's involvement in these things. And at a very young age, they were funneling weapons to Fidel Castro.
Interesting.
The CIA was funneling supplies to Castro to destabilize the Batista regime. And he's talking about what happened was that the president prior, the leader of Castro of Cuba prior to Batista, was this guy Preo, I think was his name, who Batista overthrew. Because funny enough, he was more corrupt than Batista. And so then the CIA was trying to, they got tired of dealing with Batista, and they figured, let's get Castro in there. And perhaps once we get Castro in there, we can overthrow him and put back Preo, this other guy, back in the power. And he's kind of...
Oh, wow.
And he's saying, what happened was Castro was sort of, where did he get his money? No one ever... Where did he get his money? He got like $300 million in funding. And it wasn't from the Soviet Union. It was from Meyer Lansky. It was from these CIA-related mafiosos that Barry Seal and David Ferry were working for. And again, this is this whole milieu of spies and mafiosos and those things. And so it's hard to say, you know, what line do you go from CIA to mafia? It's kind of like the lines are very. It's like Las Vegas or Disneyland for that matter. You know, you get in the intrigues of these places. If you want to look at how it really works, look at how Las Vegas was created. The intersection of entertainment, politics, and organized crime. That's Las Vegas. Well, that's the United States, too, in general. Las Vegas is a microcosm of the United States, kind of. But anyway, he was getting this intrigue. He says, so at the end of the day, Daniel Hofstadter was writing. He's trying to figure it out. So the CIA takes out Batista to put Castor in so they can put in somebody else. And so they organized Castro's revolution to take out Batista. Then they're organizing a revolution against Castro. So it was just some sort of like WPA make work program for the intelligence agencies, you know, because it does have a sort of the people involved in this is they're just running drugs, they're running guns, they're getting people killed. This is their life, you know. This is the life they lead, the life they chose, and they're just churning business up by destabilizing these areas. And it's no skin off the nose because at the end of the day, they get to fly home and eat dinner with their wives or their girlfriends or whatever. Like E. Howard Hunt. Like you got that impression during the Iran-Contra affair when Major General Richard Secord was testifying about the gun running and someone asked him about the profits. He said, well, yeah, of course there were profits. It was a business. So at what point was geopolitics just an excuse? Right? The whole Cold War is just an excuse for business to raise cash. And he even gets into this whole thing about in the 1960s, when Eisenhower was leaving office, he had this this peace initiative with the Soviet Union. He was going to end the Cold War. So he was going to meet – he had the summit with Khrushchev planned, I think, June of 1960. And he put down an order, no U-2 flights over Russia. I don't want to provoke – I don't want them to disrupt this summit meeting with Khrushchev. You know, this is only, what, 6-7 years after Stalin died in these things. So he gets this order, you know. Lo and behold, a U-2 flight is flown, and not only is Gary Powers does Gary Powers fly his U-2 flight, the plane sabotaged, so it crashes over Russia. Of course, Russia claimed they shot it down. It turns out it was probably sabotaged, so it could go low enough where it could be shot down. They disrupted the oxygen system, so Gary Powers would have to go down low. Because it would make the engine would fly. It's a high flight. They needed a converter for the oxygen up there, and it's very easy to sabotage. So you have to fly down at a level low enough where you can be shot down. But the whole point is that someone within the national security state countermanded the president's order to fly that U-2 flight over Russia during just before the summit, so they could sabotage the summit, and hence then the Cold War could continue, and all the, you know, the big contracts, the wars and these things, Vietnam and these things. So at the end of the day, you know, I guess a large part of the agenda is just making money off war and suffering.
Yes. You know? The strategy of tension in some way is political, and there are power politics parts of it. But in a larger context, I think you're right that the main thing here is economic hegemony and keeping the game going in a certain way. And yes, whether it's like even thinking through like Kennedy and Khrushchev, that it was basically elements of their high-level generals that were working to sabotage some of the conversations that Kennedy and Khrushchev were having back channel to try to shift the national investments of their of their, you know, large and powerfully economic countries from a nuclear weapons race to things like a space race and infrastructure race of some sort. And of course that was undone by things like assassinations and that type of thing.
Yeah, and if you look at LBJ, who were his backers? It was like Kellogg, Brown and Root, right? Who made billions off the Vietnam War? They're the ones that dredged the harbors and built the bases and even brought in, you know, the food and that supplied the soldiers and stuff. And at the same time, of course, that also is creating a conduit for the heroin back in the United States. You know, these things. And that
General Dynamics.
Yeah, General Dynamics and these things. So yeah, I mean, it's a business model, and you know, it's not surprising. I think it was Kennedy's taken out in '63, and then in '64, David Rockefeller flies into Moscow And I think the next week Khrushchev is fired.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And Rockefeller just manages to get in with not a problem.
Yeah. I think he could land his plane any time in Moscow during the height of the Cold War. You know, it's arch capitalist. And that goes, I guess, goes to the lie of the Cold War itself, which is you could
like Armand Hammer, yeah.
Yeah, Armand Hammer, another guy. Just that, you know, just at the end of the day, the Cold War was just a strategy of tension writ large.
Kissinger in China.
Yeah.
Rockefeller in Japan. Yeah.
Yeah.
And nowadays, it's actually it's very possible that even the threats of war now are actually part and parcel of the next generation of strategy of tension, the war of terror, the regional potential for outbreak of war, whether it's in the Korean Peninsula or Syria and Lebanon and Israel or Ukraine or these types of things. But in the background, of course, is the escalation of this high-level, high-technology cyber security, moving towards artificial intelligence, database-dominated economic strategy of tension. And this, of course, is where you see the rise through things like the Talpiot program in Israel of Israel as a sort of new superpower. And Greg found an article where David Petraeus, General David Petraeus, also taken down by some type of sexual honeypot operation, by the way. He was just in Israel at a cybersecurity conference and called Israel a cybersecurity superpower. And anyone who's been paying attention already knows that that's true. And in a certain way,
what the media reports, Israel's cyber superpower capabilities are far beyond what the media reports. That was, I believe, Petraeus' quote.
And because of the legacy of the Cold War, where the United States is sort of set up against the East and Russia and China in certain ways, Israel is the sort of middle player here. They're the broker, the man in the middle in a certain way. And they are making the cybersecurity deals with Russia. Putin and Netanyahu got together for a secret meeting after Davos and apparently made some serious decisions for the Middle East or other things. China and Israel are fusing Israeli technological innovation with the capacity of China and the Belt Road Initiative. Israel is deeply in the mix. And in a certain way, you see this the shift by Israel from being so dependent to its patron, the United States of America, towards the East. And I believe it looks like the plan is for there to be a new strategy of tension between the United States and the East. So in a certain way, what we really need is we need those elements, those high-level political and military intelligence elements that were the types that were trying to conspire behind the scenes to de-escalate the Cold War in many ways, and in certain scenarios actually saved us from potential world war and nuclear war during the Cold War. And we need those elements to begin really talking behind the scenes and de-escalating the new arms race, which in more and more is comes out of the Talpiot program and is a cyber arms race.
Yeah, sometimes when I talk about the power of the Israeli lobby, you get the Zionist state, the influence of these things, they say, well, it's such a small country. How could it have so much power? And I say, well, look at England.
British Israeli is
exactly.
Israel is.
Yeah, yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So there you go. From island to small little New Jersey island, I guess. Yeah.
So it's one of those.
I mean, meanwhile, when you want to persecute, when Israel wants to play the victim, it'll play up how small it is.
Yeah, how hopeless it is in these things. it's a Rothschild, a state. That's what it is. It's a Rothschild state, and that's the guy gets in the banking and the alchemy and the occult financing, and when it gets into this domination of when you're talking about this sort of this technological advantage that they're seeking, the sort of this you could say this what you're talking about, the cyber domination. Well, that gets into sort of the cult occultism, because what occultism really is it's the sort of a possessing secretive knowledge and control, and from that you get a certain advantages, finance, and you appear to be smarter or more powerful, and that's the kind of what the game has been
And Joseph Davis found this really creepy article in this vein recently. It was some rabbinical studies professor claiming that AI, of course, was going to play a role in the bringing back the summoning of the Messiah, the Mashiach, at the end of times, and that it was going to be involved in rebuilding the temple, and that of course AI is a part of that. Yeah, that's pretty creepy.
Yeah, yeah, that is real creepy. One thing, you were talking about the corruption of earlier civil rights movement and civil rights leaders. I saw a tweet by Catherine Austin Fitz regarding Maxine Waters. She just bought a $4 million mansion.
Oh, really?
Just public servant. She's been a congresswoman for how many? Forever. She bought a $4 million mansion. She goes, how does she afford it? And she goes, Dark Alliance? You know.
How yeah. far Maxine Waters has fallen. She was at one point actually beginning to investigate during the 90s, during the Gary Webb journalism, about the CIA cocaine running. And apparently the Russians are coming is a more profitable narrative now.
Yeah, she got the message.
And now Maxine Waters is the caricature that people want to portray of
exactly.
like the ignorant black woman criticizing the president.
Yeah, yeah, and exactly. That's what you want. That there you go, right? And she, you know, she makes her constituents happy because they have a certain perspective, and at the same time, she makes her critics happy because she presents a certain image which reinforces their preconceived notions or prejudices or their justifies their political alliances or something. You know.
Yeah, so, John Lewis works the same way down in Georgia. The Martin Luther King's close friend who does a civil rights movement anniversary conferences and dialogues with Lloyd Blankfein.
Lloyd Blankfein.
We found an op-ed John Lewis wrote invoking Martin Luther King's name to support Israel, didn't we?
Yes, we did, because there was a big controversy manufactured in many ways about how Martin Luther King was really an ardent Zionist. And certain Zionist networks actually faked a letter of some sort from him. And there was even a sort of probably massaged, if not constructed, quote from the 60s. But in the mix of this, yes, there was an article that used John Lewis, I think, to bolster the King Zionist metaphor strain.
And it was an opposition. It was an article written in opposition to the Durban, South Africa conference in 2001, which condemned Zionism as racism. This was just prior to, like, the weeks leading up to September 11th, is when that Durban conference took place, which condemned Zionism as racism. So, what a way to get support for Israel back into the public eye following that Durban conference in August 2001.
Yeah, well, it's that's the true purpose of the Black Jewish Alliance is the exploitation of that issue for the promotion of Zionism. That's the, you know, how I look at it. It's again, it's
people like Ta-Nehisi Coates.
Just there to exploit those differences, exploit those divisions, exploit real grievances often, but never look for any real solution or equity in these issues, just to exploit them.
Why isn't Ta-Nehisi Coates the editor and the former Israeli prison guard Jeffrey Goldberg his writer? So there always seems to be the positions of power in relationship to the Jewish Black so-called alliance always seems to be that one group is in the power position.
Yeah.
And you could even find that in relation to a lot of the Palestine solidarity efforts where, I don't know, I'm not going to automatically just question the motivations of any Jewish person who's involved in Palestinian solidarity activism, because I'm sure there are very people who do genuinely care about the cause of Palestine. But when you look even at, like, the Palestinian cause and the solidarity movement and the activism, it's a lot of cases it's primarily Jewish people leading these activism efforts.
Like the NAACP, it sort of rings of that.
Yeah.
I, as a Jewish American, I am sensitive, although I do have tons of solidarity with the Palestinian people. I think it's of better faith to act from my own enlightened self-interest as an American and point out that, yes, while we are in solidarity with the Palestinian people on the other side of the planet, meanwhile, The forces have come and brought Palestine, the Palestinification, here to the so-called homeland here in the United States of America, where libraries are being occupied by apparently by elements around Israeli military intelligence potentially, and more our laws are being constructed by the Israel lobby. In good news here in Kansas, a Mennonite Christian, a young math teacher who was apparently not allowed to continue on with a contract to teach math here in Kansas after Kansas passed a law basically making it illegal to be support of boycott, divestment, sanctions in solidarity with the Palestinian people and still get a contract with the state of Kansas. And in the first round here, the judge has declared it clearly unconstitutional in violation of the First Amendment and free speech laws in many different ways, and has put an injunction against that law. So that's a big first step. So the Israel lobby is, I guess, allowed to buy off large amounts of our politicians and force American Congress people to sign oaths to a foreign country. But the line in the sand, it appears, for we the American people, including our elements of our judiciary, is aspects of the First Amendment. Do not take away our logos.
Yes, it's the perhaps a bridge too far, but in the meantime, you'll be rendered unemployed.
Well, but yeah. I guess apparently she's now going to be able to get her job back. So that's one little piece, but it's a step along the way towards making a comeback here.
Yeah, there's other ways to control debate or stifle free speech in these things, and that's usually just through being ostracized. It's called what, dynamic silence is what it was called back in the 50s or 60s when people opposed. The 40s, rather, when there were personalities or political figures or spokespersons who were against the U.S. recognition of Israel, you would suddenly find if you were on the radio talking about it, your radio station would lose advertising. And I think it was the Fatal Embrace, the book talks about this, Dynamic Silence. How there'd be a silent boycott against anybody who is critical of these things. And again, this is the flexing of financial power, which is, I guess, strictly speaking, is legitimate. But at the same time, when people call this out, don't accuse those people of being conspiracy theorists and anti-Semitic. You should have to face the music. If you're organizing that fashion, that should be in the open. People should know about it. And we can judge the issue from that point instead of doing it in silence and then creating the misperception that these things are just the paranoid fantasies of neo-Nazis and racists. It's not. It's a political group, or it's an organization. They organize, Jewish power is real. They're organizations, and they should be allowed to participate, as long as they're not representing a foreign power. But when they do engage politically in these things and do organize, that organization should be able to be identified and criticized as such. Otherwise, you're not, people are misinformed, or they're not, they don't understand the correlation of forces here.
It's a great point, actually, because it's true. Like, if, let's say you want to speak, you're a rapper or something like that, and you want to speak up against Israeli policy, you're probably not going to get a good contract with Lior Cohen or something like that. But if you're a globalization studies professor at the University of Lethbridge, like Professor Anthony Hall, and you're doing all of your duties in good faith in the classroom presenting information fairly to your students, and on your own time you do your own political speech based on the facts as best you know them, to have some organization like the Judeo-Masonic B'nai B'rith to come in and basically pressure an outside organization such as your administration of your university to suspend you without pay. There's, especially since the background of that is hyper shady, and there's actually looks like there was the construction of a Facebook false flag against Professor Hall, and the B'nai B'rith was actually using those words that were planted on his page to help slander him to government officials behind the scenes and all that type of thing. That is beyond reproach, and there's large aspects of it that are probably illegal under such laws like RICO statutes and that type of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And the same thing when I offer criticism of Hollywood, where talking about the culture aggression that Hollywood, and a lot of it is of course, Hollywood is largely Jewish, at least the power structure, and they write about it. I mean, you have like Neil Gabel's book, Empire of Their Own, and it boasts about the accomplishment of Hollywood being a Jewish town and its influence on American culture and politics. And
Joel Stein in the Los Angeles
Times
wrote the same thing. Yeah, we do own the media. What about it? There was even a poll that came out that there was expressed sadness by some Jewish organization that most Americans didn't believe Jews owned the Jews, primarily, and the media disproportionately.
And my point is, okay, so you're taking collective pride for your control of Hollywood. Therefore, you have some sense of collective responsibility for what Hollywood produces and its effect on culture. So let's start the debate there. Obviously, I'm not saying every Jew influences America. You know, it's Jewish oligarchs.
Alan Dershowitz does the same thing where he'll express pride and Jewish power, like we're in control because we're so smart and enlightened, and then he's the public face denouncing anybody who says the same. He says in private is an evil anti-Semite.
People have no problem saying the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, the Germans invaded Poland. I'm not saying every German invaded Poland. I'm not saying every Japanese citizen bombed Pearl Harbor. Obviously, you know what we're talking. We speak in these general terms because there was a political entity called the Third Reich, and it was German. There's a political entity called the Empire of Japan, so we could say Japan. There is a Jewish identity, and they do exist as a political body, a people, and that can be incarnated in terms of the Mossad, Shin Bet, the Israeli state. I mean, come on, this didn't happen by accident. Obviously, there was a political organization behind this effort. And so same thing, we look at Hollywood. Hollywood exists as an organization, and it does project a certain ideological point of view, a certain social point of view. It's very liberal. That reflects the people that control Hollywood. It's also very – it's Americanist. It's Judeo-Masonic Americanist too. And so it's not just strictly Jewish. It's obviously it's Anglo-Zio-American, and there's a lot to go into there. But nevertheless, if you run the studios and you're projecting certain values with your movies and you're targeting the culture, you're subject to criticism, and you shouldn't be able to hide behind claims of anti-Semitism or victimization when you're the oligarch, for Pete's sake. You know, so that's my two cents worth on that.
And this is one of the most toxic parts of Jewish power, is that you can have the Alan Dershowitzes and the Joel Steins be able to brag on Jewish power. But then if non-Jews talk about it, then you're not allowed to talk about it, basically. And that's why I sometimes try to utilize my Jewish privilege in certain ways. It doesn't take me everywhere, but it will get me so far in being able to talk about it. And in certain ways, maybe we could unleash the Jewish revolutionary spirit instead of around the world internally, in terms of disrupting what's become a very controlling, sadistic, shady Jewish elite that utilized the Jewish masses as human shields and swords against the other peoples increasingly of the planet. So the more we can talk about things in the open, the better we're going to be. And in fact, I would say the better we are all going to be. And sure, people who depend upon criminality at whatever level, whether it's the mob type, and clear, we can talk about an Italian mafia. No one says you're anti-Italian, so we should be able to talk about Jewish mob.
You can say Russian mafia, but when you start to call the Russian mafia disproportionately Jewish mafia, then you're a bad person.
It's the same thing to do with the Bolsheviks and the Cheka, right?
NKVD or
NKVD, you know, or the
I think Alexander Solzhenitsyn's second book, The Fall of Gulag Archipelago, wasn't published on a wide scale. He talked about the Jewish nature of the oppressors in the Soviet Union.
Yeah, and that's a factor there again. It's an important factor. Yeah. So, well, listen, you think we covered it?
Do you mind if I make one quick point real quick before we go?
Sure, I think it'll tie everything. Yeah, I was just worried about your time. I got plenty of time. Just worried about your time.
Oh, no, that's fine. That's so fine. Ahead. I wanted to say a couple of months back, I think this relates to the topic of Martin Luther King and the subversion of civil rights and all this and that, is a couple months back during the height of the NFL protest, Jeremy and I did a program. We talked about Colin Kaepernick, the quarterback, mm-hmm. as being likely stage managed at some level by people in positions of power and influence. And what's interesting, much like Martin Luther King within, like, say, the alternative right community represents the epitome of decadence and evil and just corruption and lack of morals and all this and that. Kaepernick is in the same way. He's like the boogeyman, I think, in a lot of ways for the fear of the black man protesting and posing the power structure under Trump in any way, shape, or form. But it's interesting with Kaepernick. There is this, on one hand, there is this iconography being built around him. Like, he was on the cover of GQ magazine representing the face of resistance and protest, and this iconography starting to be built around him in aspects within the mainstream. But also, Kaepernick has shown at times that he has very much a conscience and a to be able to think independent-minded, such as his refusal to support either Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton in the 2016 election. He's alluded to the immorality of U.S. foreign policy at times, but there's also elements that I do believe are stage-managing him at some level, and I think we identified some of those during our program that we did a few months back on this topic. But I think it's going to be very interesting as time goes on to watch the activism of a Colin Kaepernick and see where it goes and where it heads and possible responses to it. So I think that's something to keep an eye on in the future. I think it very much relates to what happened with Martin Luther King and what's going on now in the current racial trajectory that's going on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good point. Yeah, I've always fantasized about if there are a few celebrities or they could stand up and make stand for something, and it turns out that when they do, they they're either manipulated or they're taken out. And perhaps that's the lesson from the 1960s. The moment you really start to establish challenge the system, the jackals come and get you.
Yes, and it points to that the only solutions here are not to look for icons or the singular leader, but for everybody, all of us, to increasingly, get our education on, share what we learn with each other, but not only allow our education to be it, but to begin to actually think in a political fashion and begin to organize in a political fashion, even if that really just might mean getting together in a town hall meeting, going to your city council, putting some of these facts that you know to be pertinent to even your local situation, includes things like when new police chiefs are being chosen, that type of thing. And you'd be surprised at how few people actually get politically involved. In my experience, both in terms of Los Angeles, where I'm from, but also here in Lawrence, Kansas, is that the world of politics is very small. And so, groups of people, those of us that have a certain awareness of what might be going on, and at the same time are willing to take some responsibility for putting forth a vision of what's a better, what could go on that's better, that's not utopian, but that's actually pragmatic and principled and moral and creative, then we can then step into the fold and create a politics that's not dependent on individual political leaders or celebrities that can get taken out. We can produce a political movement based on good ideas.
Yeah, and the of course, what's really pre-political, the real progress that comes is actually pre-political, is changing the culture, improving your neighborhood. One thing is making sure you have a healthy family, then improving your neighborhood, your community. And these things, that's perhaps why some of the productive efforts of the Blank Panthers were disrupted, like these food breakfast programs, these things, and why they had to be radicalized and militarized, so to ultimately render them useless, really, in the standpoint of helping the black community. And that's, again, that's that black iconography, which was almost was corporatized in the 60s and 70s. And it didn't lead to anything. This led to more destruction.
That's a great point, in that politics and culture starts in the home. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't stop there, but it does start there. And whether it's familial relations or even just being able to take care of one's own person, mind, body, soul, but also one's family, and then you just start moving it outwards. You started with a garden or something like that. You start with your neighbors and you share what you know, and you begin to collaborate in terms of a culture that you believe in, and then eventually you have a politics that has an actual real foundation.
Yeah, exactly. It's not utopian. It's based on some workaday effort and progress, and just shy away from the utopian dreams of the 20th century. Those things just led to disaster. So let's get away. It's workaday effort. And that isn't to say you can't have ideals and goals and objectives and these things, but the reality is you have to start local and build up from there. And relying on national figures, these icons and these things, or the final analysis are just tools. And if they're not tools, they're assassinated. Then you're left with nothing. And then you're left with the image or the myth of the person, like Martin Luther King, the myth of Martin Luther King. And we're given a holiday and there's streets named after him and things like that. That's supposed to compensate for everything, I suppose. But no, these are just empty. That's nothing. So, well, listen, guys, I want to thank you for coming on the show. Is there anything else you want to say or before I let you go? Or,
well, just thanks for the opportunity. We appreciate being back on.
Well,
yes.
Okay, thank you for coming on. Jeremy, anything else?
No, just appreciate your time and your effort to have conversations with people that are enlightening and deepening of the human mind and soul. So thank you.
Great. Okay, I'll let you two go and let you go to work. And I'll post this probably in a couple of days. When I do, I'll send you the link.
All right. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Take it easy.
All right. All right. Bye-bye. You too. Bye-bye.